I don't really have a plan for telling you about anything right now. I was thinking we might just sit together for this 45 minutes. However, if there's anything you'd like to ask or say, you're welcome to. Anything you'd like to hear about or talk about or ask. Yes, Molly?
Would you give us a description of jhana?
So, jhana in the Theravada system is a description that we find frequently in the suttas of four levels of meditation. And they each have certain characteristics. And in general, it's levels of letting go. So in the first jhana would be placing your mind on a meditation object. That's kind of fun.
What level is that?
That's the pre-jhana for sure. So placing your attention and then keeping it connected to that. So that's two qualities involving thought and keeping your mind on your meditation object. And then having the spiritual energy arise of piti and sukha, so joy and happiness or pleasure, spiritual pleasure though, and one-pointedness, or you really are not distracted at all. But there are a lot of different ways that different systems view the first jhana. So some people feel like it's very easy to do that, and other people feel like it's not at all easy to do that in terms of, like, what does it mean, really, in actual practice. In the second jhana, the placing your mind and keeping it connected, that falls away. Thinking falls away. And you still have the joy and the happiness. And so on, like that, you know, they just get more and more refined. And you see the description, there's a very stock set of, you know, stock description of it in the suttas. Mainly, I think, just remembering that the more we relax and stay focused and bright with our mindfulness and let go, then meditation really takes on its own life and we can become more and more settled. Yeah. Did you have something, Joe?
I want to ask if it's possible to have some suggestions about meditation.
You know, I can't hear you. Let's try the microphone.
I want to ask you about the meditation, if it's possible to give me some suggestion. I have a lot of difficulty to go beyond the narrative of my mind.
Beyond the what of your mind?
What?
Go beyond the...
Yeah, I don't know if that...
I just didn't understand the word.
Yeah, the issues I have is... I stay maybe focused for 30 seconds, it then comes when I see I am inside of a story of my mind, creator. Yes, right. I need to go back to the breathing. I do for few seconds, and then other story. Look like this story come over and over, many different stories.
Right.
And I have a lot of, I pass all the time trying to fight these stories not come in my mind. And then that has been very difficult. It's for a long time. And then come the issues of journals. Maybe I never was able to go the first journal, and get to that process. And the other thing, these stories, they came, they repeat.
Repeat
the same stories. I fight my own mind. I don't know anymore what to do. I pass for, all the meditation, fight the stories.
Yeah. So this is common for people. Oftentimes people have this experience. And when related to the previous question about jhana, Ajahn Chah didn't talk much about jhanas, even though deep meditation was part of the practice, of course. But the idea that we find a way to calm the mind, and people are different. And Ajahn Chah was one of those teachers who had the skill to really work with people in different ways because people are different. So what I think when I hear what you're describing from people, and when Ajahn Chah encountered the same thing, he said especially the Westerners that he was training, often their mind was very discursive. It wants to think. And one thing for sure is we have to accept the mind we have, in a way, train it. But so what usually is recommended that I would recommend to you is to find a meditation object that's not just the breath isn't quite subtle. There's nothing going on there. But instead, if you were to, take the reflection on the body as your meditation object, and you go through the parts of the body, and you really think about each part, imagine it and reflect upon it, and then you go to the next one. It's like you're keeping the mind, it's a discursive practice rather than just trying to silence the mind. And then that might bring more calm. And yeah, when we find ourselves fighting with something, it's like it's almost like we keep reinforcing it, right? Have you tried that?
I do the body, the five senses, the sixth sense. I do the meditation with the body.
Five khandhas or something. Khandhas,
yeah, that create another problem. I found the meditation many times when do guided meditation. I cannot go through to feel that. Uh-huh. I have a thought of that. I see this a thought, that when I go through that, I really not experience that. Mm-hmm. I'm really just have a thought about that instead to really to go and to feel my specific, for example, my feel the ground, feel the earth. I experience not the feeling, I experience a thought about that.
I see. Instead of being present with it, in it, it's a thinking about
it. It's a think about, yeah.
Is there anything... So this is a good exploration because, if you... For example, the Buddha gave many different meditation objects in the Foundations of Mindfulness, right? It's the Satipatthana Sutta. And maybe there's a method there that would be really intriguing, would really intrigue your mind, and that you would want to stay with it, and you might find a way to go beyond the labels is what you're telling me. This is what we would like to see happen. I was thinking not the five khandhas or the sense bases, but I was thinking more about the 32 parts of the body. And this is a meditation, maybe it doesn't even have to be the 32 parts, but that kind of body reflection is something that the Thai forest masters will often recommend. That this is one of the main practices they do. So that you start, it's very much related to the topic that we're looking at this week, to really, really see the body for what it is. So one monk in Thailand, his name is Ajahn Biak. He was recommending to me that I put my attention on a part of the body and then remove it from the body. You know, like it starts with the hair of the head. Like you think about your hair, and then it says if you take your hair out and you put it aside. And then the hair of the body, you'd have to take all of this beard off and put it aside. And then your fingernails and toenails, and you take them off and you put them aside. And your teeth, just like having dentures, you take it out and you put it aside. And so you go through all of the body parts like that. Your skin, you imagine what your body is like without the skin on it. And then you take that and you put it aside. And what have you got left? You've got the muscle, the whole muscular system, the bones, the organs are underneath. You take off the muscles. You take out the blood. You take out each organ, your brain, your heart, your lungs. And you go on like that. And you might think, oh, well, I can't even stick with that. But you just have to, you just keep coming back to it then. So try to reestablish your presence and awareness of these things. And you do it over and over again. All of this, you keep taking, take it out. And then when everything's gone, you've taken out all of the bones, there's nothing left. He said then you take out your citta, which is mind. Whatever that is. And a lot of times the Thais will point here and the Westerners point here, and you take that out, and then you feel what it's like to have nothing there. And then you put each one back in. Citta first. Each one goes back inside. You can make a list at first of the body parts if you want to. Just follow it. When you're just starting to like get the mind involved in this activity of really looking at the body and see if that helps to
lighten the load.
Lighten the load. Thank you very much. Yeah, something like that. Something that you might find in, you know, the mind finds interesting enough. And the other place to look is what you're doing the rest of your time when you're not meditating. Because the meditation is really a reflection of whatever else is going on. You know how when you dream, you can see elements of your experience from that day or that week or whatever? And the meditation can be like that too. It's just, it's busy, it gets, the mind gets a lot of stimulation, and then it's hard for it to settle down. So sometimes doing something really calming before you meditate, get ready to meditate. Any of that sound interesting?
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Just had a very quick follow-up to that. Can you say a little bit more about the purpose of contemplating putting everything back again?
Well, I think it's a matter of finding another way to focus. You keep the mind engaged, and you're still really observing the body for what it is. Mm-hmm. The actual, you know, like most of the time we think of the body, we're just looking at the shell, the outside, mm-hmm. right? But you're looking at it inside and outside. And this is exactly what the Buddha told people to do too. And so the benefit, I think, from Ajahn Biak's idea is that it keeps the mind engaged and you really are, you know, present with those body parts as you put it back all together. And then notice how it feels. Like, how do you feel? It's like any kind of meditation you're doing with the body, you know, like paying attention to, even if you don't go internal with the body, you know, like if you put your attention on some body part and you know, and then you notice how different, if you go down one side of your body, then you notice how different that feels from the side you haven't looked at yet. So really, really being present with how it feels. And then Ajahn Beg said, at some point your body will explode.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, I think.
Yeah. We sometimes call that hair of the head, hair of the body, skin, nails.
Nails, teeth, skin, yeah. Nails,
The already dead meditation.
Oh.
As part of impermanence, because all those parts, like the outer layer of skin,
oh,
your teeth, your nails, they're dead. They're not alive.
At least there are cells shedding from the skin all the time. Skin's pretty alive, really, but yeah. Yeah, already dead. Yeah. Sometimes when I teach about impermanence, I'll talk about, you know, we never know what's going to happen. And if I die tonight, first you're going to have to get over the, hey, I paid for the whole week. But then make use of it, right? You know, lay me out here and look at that. Just look at that and really, really get all you can from it, okay?
I just wanted to ask if you could talk a little bit about the five hindrances and freeing ourselves from the five hindrances. You mentioned earlier that being free of those is something that we hopefully could achieve regularly. And I'm unsure that happens for me.
Yeah. So the first one is desire, sensual desire, if we keep wanting something. Now, first I'll tell you what they are, kind of explain what they are in case you don't know. Most of you probably do know, but sensual desire, ill will or aversion. Sometimes they call the third one sloth and torpor. It's that dullness and drowsiness. Yeah.
It's my favorite.
Sloth and torpor. Yeah. Restlessness, and sometimes they call it regret or remorse or restlessness and worry. Something like that, or doubt, kind of the mind flipping back and forth. And these first four, they're arranged, actually, there are pairs, right? So the desire, the sensual desire and the ill will or aversion is like you want something, you want something, or you want to get rid of something. And it's kind of two sides of the same coin, you're wanting. And the drowsiness and dullness versus the restlessness is also two sides of the same coin. A lot of times we're very overstimulated, we sit down, and as soon as we get quiet, we want to fall asleep. Or we go from that, we wake up, and then the mind is running around. It's restless. And then doubt, of course, is like, maybe it's doubt about whether I'm doing the right thing, whatever it is. It's flipping back and forth. The mind just keeps that wobble going. It's like, so when any of these are quite strong, you need to address them directly. So the strongest kind of sensual desire that I know of is when you really have a strong sexual desire. And that can really occupy a person's mind. Uh-huh. And the Buddha said there's nothing else that occupies a man's mind more than the sight of a woman or the sound of a smell, taste, touch of a woman. And he says exactly the same thing for women about men. And of course, we know it doesn't end there. It could be anybody, right? And when that kind of strong desire is there, the recommendation is peel off the skin. And it really does help to remember that what's just below this little thin, it's getting thinner all the time, by the way, this thin covering, it's not very attractive. And so that can help us cool it. And with other kinds of desire, you know, just trying to look at what's really there, what is it really that I feel like I want or need? What's the pull? Or the aversion, if there's a lot of aversion in the mind, what can we do? One of the things we can do is develop our metta to counteract it. Sometimes it's so hard, you've got so much you can't even go to metta, right? But maybe there's a way to look at, well, what is triggering this negativity? And can I bring some care to myself over that and look at what I might do? Maybe I have to change something in my life. Sloth and torpor, a lot of times that comes up, like I said, maybe we're overstimulated and overworked, or maybe we're just not happy. A lot of times when we're not happy and we're not really addressing the source of that discontent, that unhappiness, then a lot of times we just want to fall asleep. I mean, just, you know, check out. It could also be trauma related. We want to really look at and see what we need to do to support the mind. With restlessness too, it usually, often anyway, has to do with what's going on in our life. Maybe too much stimulation. You know, we're so used to, especially if we spend a lot of time on devices, and you know. Of course, it's not a new problem. It didn't come with technology. The Buddha talked about it too. You know, it's like the mind can be very restless. And the regret part, like maybe there's stuff coming up about the past, you know, and in talking about stories that come up and repeat, maybe we do want to look at the content of those stories. If there's kind of this kind of ongoing kind of you know, disturbance to the mind about something, maybe we want to take a look at what's really behind it. In the light of Dhamma, sometimes it's good to talk to a teacher about what's there. Maybe they can help us understand what might be behind it. And doubt, most of the time, if we're having doubts about things that bother us during meditation or even when not when we're meditating, the best thing to do is seek out wisdom or find out what might be an answer to this question, or talk to someone who would know. And the more we come to understand things, the less doubt we're likely to have, obviously. But a lot of times I find we don't really need to deal with these directly because they're more subtle. It's just that the mind is not settled and it takes one of these routes to be manifesting or the example or the instance of this unsettledness. In which case, a lot of times having an object in our meditation that the mind finds interesting and wants to engage with, then these hindrances just fall away. Like, you know, you might have had the experience of being on retreat and having the teacher give guided meditation that takes you really deep. Maybe day after day you're going deeper with this kind of reflection. And then you'll notice at some point that the hindrances are just gone. If you happen to take stock. And so that's a very nice way to lose the hindrances. sometimes when we're meditating, it's really a matter of developing a good relationship with our meditation object. Like, how do you start to love the breath? To really appreciate the breath, to really see the beauty of the breath. Make the breath really your friend. Make it your friend off the cushion, you know, like being with the breath, you know, while you're doing other things. And, you know, sometimes it's like you have to get into it. You might find that with people too. If you find somebody annoying, you know, start to appreciate their good qualities and really put more effort into your interactions with them, and pretty soon you're going to be liking them more. At least I find that can happen. Ajahn Pasano would often say, according to some of his students, if you can't get out of it, get into it. And our attitude towards things really matters. Don't make yourself meditate. I mean, okay, sometimes, yes. But you have to, like, help yourself be ready to meditate. If you're forcing yourself to meditate, it's like, you have to sit here this long and you're going to, like, focus on this object. Ajahn Brahm does a very good job of talking about, you know, like, if your friend invites you to go have coffee or tea or something, and they say, oh, we're going to meet at this place, it's got to be at this time, and you're going to drink this drink, and we're going to just stay there this long, and, you know, and you got to pay attention to just this thing. It's like, who wants to go? You know, this is what we're doing to the mind. You know, it's like, can we learn about our mind and understand when it's ready to meditate? And if you happen to be able to go on a long retreat, then you've got time to do that. You can look, well, what is my mind? What is my mind ready to what meditate as soon as I roll out of bed in the morning? Or is it ready to meditate, you know, mid-morning or later? You know, what's the best time of day? You know, what does it need to focus on, you know, when it's not ready to sit and meditate? Can we go walking? Walking in nature? You know, putting attention on, you know, using a guided meditation or doing some mindful movement. You know, this last 3 months during the rains period, I noticed, and things change over time. Our body changes, our mind changes too. So I noticed that there were times when I would sit down and I'd immediately want to fall asleep, and I knew that my mind was not ready to meditate. So I either just go take a rest or go do a mindful walk or something like that. And then when I would come back, a lot of times if I'll just rest for 20 minutes and then sit, and my mind is bright and ready to go. And so really, you know, really observing the mind. And then if you're happy, you're going to have much better meditation. You really have to be happy. I actually had a handout made. I could have brought it now that we're into this, but I'll give it to you later. Showing this transcendent chain of dependent origination, and you know, you really get the feeling, you know, like the mind being happy is so critical to being able to be calm and open for insight to arise. And you can read a lot about the five hindrances. There are some nice books. I kind of like Venerable Tiradam. I think it's Tiradamo's book on the hindrances. And, you know, if you search around a little bit, you can find things about it, about them. So many practitioners have dealt with them. There is a lot to be said. You know, and meditation objects that the Buddha recommends, like I said, there are a lot of different ones, and You know, some of them are really recommended for particular issues that come up in meditation, like the unbeautiful aspects of the body for sensual desire, you know, metta meditation to help with ill will. And there are others in the suttas like that. Yeah, Allie? Yeah, there's a microphone coming your way.
So you spoke this morning about the staying with energy when the body begins to relax in meditation, and the different ways to bring in different aspects of relaxation with your lovely fourth and the directions. And as I sat this morning in our inquiry earlier, I couldn't remember my question, and it's shown up again. And so I'm wondering, while in meditation, what is the difference, or what is the contrast, or what might be a way to understand a thought and an insight? And my other stretch question is, how is that related or not to the deathless, this arising of insight, if it's not me, right? And if it's not the recurring redundancy of the mind doing its thing.
Yeah, so insight, it brings you something new. And sometimes it's quite surprising. I was remarried, and my kids were pretty much grown up. My son was a monk already, so I was really practicing a lot, and I think I was in seminary at that time, or I had already finished, I don't know. But I was really reflecting a lot on those phrases that we chanted yesterday. Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, all those things. And I was really looking at the impermanent nature of things. And in this reflection, particularly of suffering, I started to reflect on, why do we do the things that we do with our time? And my husband, who is a real sweetheart, he had a tropical fish tank. And he spent quite a lot of time. Every once a week, he would clean it, and he would, you know, he was very meticulous about it, and there was always some kind of drama with the fish tank, like two fish would be fighting, and he would create a section in the fish tank for one to stay in there so they wouldn't fight with each other, or a fish would get sick, and he would create a hospital tank outside the main tank and then give it medication, and sometimes a fish would get too big for the tank, and he'd take it back to the fish store and get a different fish. And I'm thinking, not to criticize him necessarily, but just all kinds of things. Like, why do we spend our time on this stuff? Is it just to sit and look at the beautiful fish? Is it just to have something to do? You know, what is it? And then I was going up to the monastery in Northern California. It's called Abhayagiri quite frequently. And I would go for a couple nights and then come back. And one day when I was just about to leave, he said to me, you know, the fish tank is perfect. It's the best it's ever been. I got four fish. They're all different. They're all beautiful. They're all getting along. They're all healthy. It's great. And I thought, uh-oh. Because, you know, impermanence. And before I even left, one of the fish, the next morning, I guess I wasn't leaving that day. The next morning, one of the fish is floating on top. And then I think shortly after that, another one died. And he didn't know, you know, what was wrong. And by the time I got back from my little trip gone, a third one had died, and the last one was looking pretty bad. And I was standing by the kitchen sink washing dishes, I think, or something. And it's like fish tanks are suffering. And the very next thought was, family is suffering. And something really flipped in my mind. Like, the only way I can describe it is that I had a whole different feeling about everyone in my life. All of my mom, my kids, my husband. And I had this incredible love for every living being. And it was the exact same feeling when I would think about the snails on the sidewalk or the little worms that would come out when it would rain and my daughter. And I'll just give you a little, if this ever happens to you, don't tell your daughter. However, and it was an amazing understanding that has never gone away, but for a long time it was so pronounced. And she was just about to go on a trip, and usually, you know, a mother, it's like, I hope she's going to be safe and it's all going to be okay. None of that. Loving her just like loving every other being. That's insight. And it just happens as a result of the practice. And when it happens, it's really good to like take a snapshot of that moment and remember the message and the feeling, and come back to it again and again. Whether it feels like a big insight or a small one, you know that it's the Dhamma. And it's related to Nibbana, the deathless, because you're losing the delusion that's keeping you from realizing the deathless. And when we realize the deathless, all of the desire and aversion and confusion are gone. Yeah. And then, you know, with that kind of insight, then all you want to do is help people, and love them. Yeah. And family is suffering, by the way. All the attachment, it's not the people, it's not the relationships, it's our attachment to it. There's nothing inherently problematic with any of the stuff in the world. It's all about how we relate to it. We relate to it with desire and aversion and all these other things, but it's not about the thing, you know. It's not about the bell. It's not about the snow falling off the roof. We can relate to it however, you know, like it's really cool, it's fun, it's scary, it's annoying, whatever, but that's all about us. There's no inherent, like, you know, you feel attracted to someone, maybe someone you shouldn't be attracted to or you shouldn't be involved with. It's not about them. It's not about what they're wearing. It's not about any of that. It's about us. So we have to remember that, because that's also where we have the power to change. We can do something about that. Can't do much about what's going on out there. So it's a good thing that it's really our own business. I did hear about someone who, this was at a conference that was held at San Francisco State University, I think, on mindfulness. And the people who put it together weren't really even Buddhist, I don't think, but they were very concerned about the sort of mindfulness trend, and they were concerned about what might problems that might arise out of teaching people mindfulness without the context of the other factors of the Dhamma. And they invited so many cool speakers there, monastics and researchers and, you know, all different kinds of people relating to this issue. And one of the stories was about a woman who, because she was doing a lot of deep meditation or mindfulness practice, but I'll go into like why I think this has happened, but she had this experience where she suddenly didn't feel the same way about her kids, you know, like she didn't have the motherly connection and love for them. She said she'd go through the motions, put them to bed at night, but that just fell away. But what wasn't there that I noticed was the love and the joy, the universal metta. And I think that does come probably from not putting attention on the other aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path. So building a balanced practice. So it is something to reflect on, you know, really looking at things like what suffering is and the unbeautiful and the, you know, all these different components and not just mindfulness itself. And I've heard this is something I read about this woman. She was in the UK and at work they had this mindfulness kind of workshop, or I don't know what they called it, seminar. Everybody was required to go. Well, that's a recipe for disaster right there. And, you know, the instructor was asking them to be aware of their breath and watching their breath, and suddenly she felt like she was choking and suffocating. And she just wanted to get up and run out of the room. And probably because of the pressure of being among her work colleagues. I mean, who wants to do a thing like this with your work coworkers? you know, required. It's like, anyhow, it really took her down a path of you know, it awakened a bunch of trauma for her. And so it's really very, very important for us to be able to pay attention to what's happening for ourselves and tuning into ourselves and learning about our own mind so that we can take care of ourselves and give the mind what is actually going to help it. And, you know, forcing ourselves to do something that we really, even though it's supposed to be the right thing, even though it's supposed to be good for us, it may not be the right time for us. Any other questions? Yeah, Sarah.
I'm deeply curious about two things. One is whether, in relation to desire for anything, I've had some success in like, just like meeting that with compassion, whatever it is that comes up, mm-hmm. and then letting it dissolve.
Letting it pass, yeah.
And is that like, is that a durable solution?
As long as it's not overwhelming you, the main thing is you're there observing it, holding it, noticing the changes, that's great. It's kind of like the, you know, focusing idea, or, you know, it's the thing is, you don't want to be pushed and pulled around by it, making decisions from that place, you know, doing things that are unhealthy, you know. So yeah, the desire comes and you observe it and you let it go, and having kindness and compassion is great, since we really want to keep that kindness, gentleness, and letting go intention going alive all the time. So we want to meet our practice, we want to meet our experience with that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The second question I had was about sort of more mundane, or it seems more mundane, but about the precepts. And music and dancing, and I was curious about that, sort of especially in relation to some of what you were just saying about it's not the thing, it's how we relate to it, and how that, yeah, maybe how relating to those things through the precepts could support us or not. Yeah
So it's good to understand the distinction between the five precepts and the eight precepts. And of course, the five precepts are there for a strong moral basis. So virtue and keeping our karma clean, so we don't, you know, we don't have problems with, you know, our life taking a bad turn, what comes back to us as a result of killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, and substance use that causes us to lose our mindfulness and do those other things. You know, like that's a different level. And then when we take the We turn that third precept into celibacy, and we take those other three, they're really training precepts. So if we want to put a lot more of our attention on our practice, then leaving out entertainment, beautification, and adornment, leaving out, you know, much messing around with food, gives you a lot more time, and it keeps your mind more on the practice. But there's another piece to this Because when you think about what do you do when you feel upset, what do? Do you turn on the TV? Do you go to the refrigerator? Do you want to sleep? You know, if you look at those things, have sex, you know, what do? You know, and if instead of being able to do any of those things because you've decided you're not going to, then you have to be present with those feelings and work with them. So it's a bit of a pressure cooker. And it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with dancing or music or singing, and a lot of times it can be incredibly uplifting and inspiring, depending on what we choose. But, you know, it, as a training, especially if you live in a monastic community, then if everybody's on that page, it's very helpful. And there's a kind of, it's a pressure cooker kind of situation. You know, you can't just, like, let the steam off through distraction. One time when I was going through a really hard time, it was after that wonderful man that I told you about told me he didn't want to be married anymore. That was a lot to take. And I was working with all of the waves of feeling and I found myself desperately wanting to shop. I'm like, I don't like to shop. Like, I am in really bad shape. Just anything to distract myself, you know. And so sometimes when we go through something like that, we may need to have a bit of a distraction for a while. Like, you want to watch that movie and not think about this for a while. And that's okay, but you're doing it consciously. Okay, I'm going to set all this aside for the moment, and I'm going to give myself a break and put my mind on something else, and then I'm going to come back to it. But it's not just blind, deluded, seeking some way to not feel. So I think it's time for most of y'all to meditate, and for Lisa, Porfi, Suzanne, and Zonio to meet me over there in the classroom. What?
I cannot get straight where I am. I've been going back and forth so many times, and it seems to keep changing. So.
We're going to the classroom for our little group, and then you won't have to think about that again because it's only going to happen once. Okay. I want to just, before we go, I just want to say how much I appreciate all of you. You're working at this, you're paying attention, you're good, kind, loving folks, and I am really appreciative of your presence here.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.